Recorded live.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Pastor Eli James here, along with Pastor William Finke, for another installment of Christogenos. And this evening, we're going to be continuing our study in the book of Ezekiel. And I think we're, the 14th or 15th? I don't know, this is 11. Ezekiel 11. And we've still got about 14, 15 chapters to go. We're right at chapter 31. And last week, we ended at chapter 31, I think verse 6. And before we're probably going to start from the top of chapter 31 for continuity's sake. But, Bill, you said that you had some comments on like last week's show.
Well, right. I just had a quick recap. Yeah, you know, recently we saw on how many occasions in history the great kings fell into the trap of claiming themselves to be gods.
Right.
And one thing I didn't explain, and I probably should have, you could only squeeze so much in a program, right? What was how this contrasts with David. David was the nearly ideal Israelite king. David saw the honor of sitting on the throne of Yahweh as a responsibility.
Right.
And David always professed and believed that he himself was functioning as a representative of Yahweh, the God of Israel,
mm-hmm.
and that he was sitting on the throne of Yahweh and not on his own throne. And David always understood that it was Yahweh, God, who handed him this responsibility.
Right.
And he treated it in that manner, caring for the people and not tyrannizing them.
And he started out as a simple shepherd.
Yes, he did.
That had a lot to do with it. Yeah.
Now, David did not issue his own laws and decrees. I don't remember one instance.
Uh-huh.
But rather, he always professed to love the laws of Yahweh.
Right.
And if we loved and kept that law so much today as David did, we would certainly have none of the troubles which we have today.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Last week, after we finished the Lamentations over Tyre and the king of Tyre, when we saw were Israelites.
Right.
We observed how out of order the chapters of Ezekiel were. And let me note that this must be something that happened before the Septuagint was translated.
Okay.
Because that edition has most of the same confusion and some additional confusion in one spot, and it doesn't help any in understanding. Basically, these chapters are out of order, and that's it. And most of these out-of-order chapters from 28 through chapter 30 have to do with the oracles against Egypt
mm-hmm.
and the final destruction of Egypt along with the other Hamitic nations of Africa.
Right.
Now, also in the Lamentation of the King of Tyre, we saw that the phrase Garden of God and the word Eden are metaphors which do not necessarily reflect back to Genesis chapters 2 and 3, but rather they are used to describe wherever the Adamic race is planted at any given time.
Right.
And we saw that same thing again, and perhaps more convincingly, here in the beginning of Ezekiel chapter 31, where the Garden of God is a metaphor for the Adamic race as
mm-hmm.
a whole, and the Assyrian is, a picture is drawn of the Assyrian being the tallest tree in that garden
mm-hmm.
because they were the mightiest empire
right.
of the time. And this is in times contemporary to Ezekiel and not to Adam and Eve.
Right.
And that's also how it's described in Revelations chapter 22, the race of Israel and the city with the with the 12 gates, and inside the city is a river, and next to the river is the tree of life, and it's this the phrase Garden of God itself does not appear explicitly, but our race is certainly that tree of life, and Christ
right.
is the root, right?
Right.
Now, Comparé held the ridiculous view, and to me is ridiculous, that since the Garden of God is mentioned here in Ezekiel chapter 31, that the Assyrian could not have descended from Shem, as the scripture clearly states. And I'd like to read I'd like to read and comment upon a paragraph from Comparé's sermon entitled Adam Was Not the First Man,
okay.
which is available on Clifton's website and I think probably on a New Ensign site too.
Right.
Now, indeed, the truth is that the Assyrians are Shemites. It's stated explicitly in Genesis chapter 10. It's stated explicitly in many other pericopes in Scripture, citations in Scripture. And that the Garden of God just happens to be any place where our Adamic race is, and therefore Mesopotamia here in Ezekiel 31, what with all of the Adamic Genesis 10 nations, I mean, many of them still live in and around Mesopotamia, and that's the Garden of God as it's pictured here. And,
right.
And we're going to see Comparé's error here, and he states that, quote, the Garden of Eden was not a plantation of ordinary trees and shrubs. Yahweh did nothing so foolish as to make a special creation just to have a man wield shovel and pruning shears when he had already had millions of pre-Adamites available for this type of work.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's no bearing for that in Scripture.
Okay. Yeah.
We are told that the Garden of Eden contained a tree of knowledge, and he has in parentheses, or experience, I gather, of good and evil. No tree of the forest has any knowledge or experience of either good or evil. I agree with like three quarters of this, right?
Right.
Ezekiel chapter 31 says, behold, the Assyrian was a cedar in Lebanon with fair branches and a shadowing bow and of a high stature. Therefore, his height was exalted above all the trees of the field, and his boughs were multiplied and his branches became long. All of the fowls of heaven made their nest in his boughs, and under his branches did all the beasts of the field bring forth their young, and under his shadow dwelt all great nations. The cedars in the garden of Yahweh could not hide him. The fir trees were not like his boughs, and the chestnut trees were not like his branches. And he's quoting this very chapter of Ezekiel we're about to cover again.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes on to say that, obviously, the trees in the garden of Yahweh in Eden were family trees of races and nations who admired and envied the early Assyrian Empire. So what Comparé is doing is he's taking this Assyrian Empire and moving it back to before the time of Adam.
Okay.
And that's where he drives off a cliff.
Okay, right.
Instead of realizing that all of this Garden of Eden metaphor is drawing a picture of the Adamic race at the time of the Assyrian Empire.
Right.
He fails to realize that, and he tries to take the Assyrian Empire and move it back to before the time of Adam.
Yeah.
Now Asher, Asher, all theologians, all scholars, all Semitic scholars agree. I don't know anybody with any common sense that would disagree that the Assyrians are the descendants of Asher, and that's clearly drawn out in Scripture.
Right. So he's saying that the Assyrians are not the descendants of
he's
Adam?
Moving them back to before the time of Adam
and
the Garden of Eden. He's making them part of the tree of knowledge of good and evil.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And he goes on to say, these made up the garden Adam was to cultivate.
Uh-huh.
Satan had been what we might call the superintendent of this planet to rule it in obedience to Yahweh's will. I don't quite agree with that. Until he forfeited this position by rebellion against Yahweh.
Mm-hmm.
But, I don't think he's Satan before he rebelled, right?
Right.
And that's the part I don't agree with.
Right, right. Yeah.
Now, Adam was sent to take his place. It was Adam's job to rule the nations and races of the earth as Yahweh's representative here. I don't believe that. Educating them in Yahweh's laws and enforcing obedience to these other races and nations had been here long before Adam, and he's counting the Assyrians as being among them.
Now,
I believe that the garden Yahweh planted was the garden of the Adamic race, okay? And Adam was its patriarch, it's all metaphoric language, and Adam, the fall of our race, came through Adam. And that's what I believe. So Genesis 1, creation of Adam, where Adam is created, it's both plural and singular. That's the way it's depicted in Scripture.
Mm-hmm.
It's really a parable more than it is a scientific creation account. And Comparé, I think he drives off a cliff with the pre-Adamic races, that there's nowhere in Scripture where Adam is to rule over so-called pre-Adamic races.
Mm-hmm.
Pre-Adamic races are not even in within the scope of Scripture. That now the Assyrian is clearly the descendant of Asher. The people of Assyria descended from Shem, who Asher was a brother of Arphaxad, the ancestor of the Hebrews.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that's scriptural. Comparé really drove off a cliff with this. He should have realized he had to do was realize that the Garden of Eden, the Garden of God, they're metaphors for the Adamic race wherever it exists at any given time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and certainly taking this chapter of Ezekiel and trying to place it in the garden or before the garden, yeah, I don't see any justification.
Well, he's really trying to take He's trying to say that this picture of the Assyrian being drawn is the Assyrian from before the garden.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really it's silly. It's parochially silly.
I think he's trying. Well, he's trying to argue a two seed line argument, you know, and he's going overboard with it, which is not uncommon for two seed liners to do, right? Trying to find new ways of justifying, you know, which teaching, in my mind, you know, is totally evident from Scripture. You don't have to invent new arguments.
Well, right. We don't have to invent anything to support two seed line.
Right. Yeah. Okay. All right. Very good. All right. So let's any more before we get back to chapter 31.
No, that's enough for me.
Okay. Yeah. Because we have to be careful not to, you know, we've got enough bad chronology here in the book of Ezekiel to invent more. You know, now I do, I think in chapter 28, there's a metaphorical reference to, you know, thou, it could mean to have a dual meaning, you know.
Well, that's because, like, you know, the way I see it, that's because those words
passage.
Can be spoken of any Adamic king who exalts himself over his brethren and starts thinking that he could be God,
Right. Yeah, and all I mean by that is the king of in this case it's
Tyre.
What is it? Is it Sidon or
Tyre?
Tyre, right. The king of Tyre exalts himself the same way that Satan exalted himself. Okay, necessarily a direct reference to the Garden of Eden. Okay, so
David was a man after God's own heart. He never exalted himself over his brethren.
And
he embraced Yahweh's laws. He never issued his own decrees. Here says David, today you shall do this or you shall die. Yeah, you know, that's something Pharaoh quite often did.
Yeah.
But, David loved his brethren and understood that he had a responsibility from God and never exalted himself above men, even though Yahweh exalted David because he was humble.
Right.
And that's, you know, that's the teaching of Christ.
Yes, and he never presumed to invent new laws like the Pharisees do.
Well, right. He loved God's law, and he embraced it, and he more or less propounded it before the people.
Right.
You know, he advertised it.
And Josiah did that, too. He was one of the few good kings of either Israel or Judah. There were only three or four good kings in the whole history.
Well, right. It was all so-and-so reigned 6 years and did evil.
Right. Exactly. Only a few of them actually did good. All right. Okay, well, let's get into I'll just start from the top, Ezekiel 31, verse 1. And it came to pass in the 11th year, in the third month, in the first day of the month, that the word of Yahweh came to me, saying, Son of man, speak to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and to his multitude, whom are you like in your greatness? Behold, the Assyrian was a cedar, so we're talking about past tense of Assyria, in Lebanon with fair branches, and fair branches would be white people, and with a shadowing shroud, and of a high stature, and its top was among the thick boughs. The waters made him great, and of course, the kingdom of Assyria extended from the Gulf of India? The Gulf of Aqaba, I forget what that area is called.
Well, the empire, the kingdom of Assyria was actually concentrated in northern Mesopotamia.
Right.
Above Sumer. Yeah, you know, the districts between the rivers, right, Mesopotamia, the land between the rivers, were Sumer and Akkad. And they're popular names in ancient inscriptions and in the Bible. And Sumer was the lower half of Mesopotamia, which included Babylonia. And Sumer is the oldest name for that region that our race knows.
Right.
It's also called Chaldea later on.
Yeah.
When
Babylon took it over.
Well, Babylonia is the part of it around Babylon, right, the major metropolis. Now, Akkad is the part to the north, and Akkad is the land of Assyria.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's basically their core district, so to speak. Like England is the core district of the English people, but they spread out beyond their borders.
Exactly.
Now the Assyrian Empire, it covered from Egypt all the way to the Indus River.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
and all the way north to the Caucasus Mountains and parts of eastern Anatolia.
Yeah, so it went from the Mediterranean to the Gulf of Aqaba, if I have it right. Where the Tigris and Euphrates rivers dump into the Indian Ocean.
Gulf of Aqaba is the is where Ron Wyatt thinks that the Israelites crossed. That's in the right.
Oh, okay. That's I can't say. Well, anywhere the rivers dump into the Indian Ocean, and of course they migrated.
Well, the Indus River was typically the frontier of the empires.
Mm-hmm.
The Persian. It was definitely the Persian frontier, but it was most surely the earlier mm-hmm. Babylonian Empire frontier and the Akkadian frontier.
Right. Yeah. So this verse 4. I mean, it's very accurate in terms of talking about waters and rivers, and that this empire was a huge empire. That's what these verses are trying to tell us. It was one of the largest of all, and I think the Egyptian empire was also great, but it never really had a great eastern presence. You know, it was mainly around the eastern border of the Mediterranean Sea. And some points eastward, but never it was never as huge as the Assyrian Empire. Okay?
Well, right. Egypt wasn't half the size. It was always buttressed It was always fronted. It was opposed to the first Babylonian Empire,
mm-hmm.
and even at its height, it didn't control much more than parts of Palestine, and projected its power into what later became known as Greece and Anatolia.
Right.
North.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Okay. So let me repeat verse 4. The waters made him great. That is, we're talking about the Assyrian Empire. The deep set him up on high with its rivers running round about its plants and sent out its little rivers to all the trees of the field. So it had various mini kingdoms that attached to its huge empire. Verse 5. Therefore, its height was exalted above all the trees of the field. And as you said, up to this point in history, it was the largest empire ever, and its boughs were multiplied, and its branches became long because of the multitude of waters, which are people, when he shot forth. All the fowls of heaven made their nests in its bough, and under its branches did all the beasts of the field bring forth their young, and under its shadow dwelt in all great nations. Now, do you consider this expression here, beasts of the field, to be a reference to non-Adamic people here?
Well, yes, I do, because mm-hmm. it's talking about nations and peoples and the fowls of heaven and the beasts of the field. In other words, all of the that there are non-Adamic people. The Hittites are a part of the Assyrian Empire,
uh-huh.
and other non-Adamic people, the Kenites and other non-Adamic people in the region who would be metaphorically considered and often are considered beasts of the field in the Bible,
right,
would be included in that description. Now is very similar to the parable that Christ made about the kingdom of heaven being the smallest of all seeds, comparing it to the mustard seed.
Mm-hmm.
And when it grows into a great tree, the birds of heaven and the beasts of the field come and nest in its branches.
Right.
And they are also metaphors to the non-white metaphors or illustrations of the non-white nations.
Yeah,
and when you see
the
Anglo-Saxon Germanic people and the nations that we've blossomed into, and we have all of the other races pushing their way into our nations.
Right. Okay. Verse 7, and this is where we left off. We left off with verse 6 last time. Now into verse 7. Thus was he fair in its greatness, in the length of its branches, for its root was by great waters. Of course, the root was Mesopotamia. Verse 8, the cedars in the garden of God could not hide him. The fir trees were not like its boughs, and the chestnut trees were not like its branches, nor any tree in the garden of God was like to him in its beauty.
So what we have here is we have the Genesis 10 white nations being described as cedars, chestnuts,
right,
and firs.
Yes. And now it's interesting that the secular reference to the Aryan people is usually the ash tree. Is there any, are you aware of any scriptural references to the ash tree or no?
Not offhand.
No, okay.
I haven't really.
Yeah, I'm not aware of it either. You know, so
Clifton's done some research in that area, but I haven't looked at it.
Uh-huh. Okay, verse 9. I have made him fair by the multitude of its branches, so that all the trees of Eden that were in the garden of God envied him. Therefore, thus says Yahweh, because you have lifted up yourself in height, and he has shot up its top among the thick boughs, and its heart is lifted up in its height, I have therefore delivered him into the hand of the mighty one of the heathen, that he surely shall deal with him. I have driven him out of his for his wickedness. Okay, so the Assyrian Empire was overthrown by what? The Medes and Persians? Or that was Babylon?
Well so the Assyrian Empire, yeah, you know, something a lot of people miss, and I don't even think it's very well known in identity circles. Herodotus talks about the 28 years that the Scythians ruled over all Asia. And it was during that 28-year period, and I could establish this through the chronology of Herodotus himself, even though Herodotus gives the Medes the distinction of having overthrown the Assyrian Empire primarily.
Right.
Basically, it can be shown to have happened during the 28-year period that the Scythians ruled all Asia.
And, of course, they're Israelites.
Yes, they are. They're definitely Israelites. There's no doubt in my mind, and it could be well demonstrated in history and in inscriptions, that the Israelites destroyed Assyria, okay? Not all of the Israelites, but a large branch of the Scythians destroyed Assyria and withdrew and gave up their hegemony in Mesopotamia and Media at that time, and crossed Asia and Anatolia and raided the cities, and they sacked and razed several cities in Lydia, but the Greeks called them Cimmerians. They destroyed Assyria, fell from 612 to 608 BC.
Mm-hmm.
And Homer started writing right around that time.
Right.
And Homer, and this can be demonstrated from the elegiac poet Archilochus, who wrote about these things and claimed to be a witness to these things and a contemporary of Homer.
And
Archilochus's works are really not read by students of history, and that's, you know, he's an mm-hmm. elegiac poet, and he's easy to pass over, right? The better students of Mesopotamian history would probably miss this. But Archilochus testified to these things. Homer knew the Cimmerians that had crossed Anatolia, destroyed Phrygia, the empire of the famous King Midas. Everything he touched turned to gold.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Cimmerians were about the end of him, right? They sacked Lydia, and they crossed into Europe from Anatolia at that very time, right at the end of the 7th century BC, right around 600 BC. Now, they 200 years they're invading Rome, and they're called Gauls, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the beginning of the Latin culture. That's when it really blossomed. The later stages of the Latin culture is when the children of Israel traveled down the Danube. We have about 8 years between the destruction of Assyria and the destruction of Phrygia and the crossing of the Israelites, that first wave of them called Cimmerians by the Greeks, into Europe. And from that time, the Medes had the hegemony, but for a very short time until the time of Cyrus, about 50 or 60 years. So the Medes got the political credit even from the Greeks for having destroyed the Assyrian Empire.
Uh-huh.
Now, at one time, the Medes did have Nineveh under siege, and the Scythians came to the rescue of Nineveh.
Okay. They were on the other side?
time and drove the Medes away, But later on, and not so many years later on, the Medes in league, the Scythians in league with the Medes and the Persians, and probably the Babylonians destroyed Nineveh. and all the great cities of Assyria.
Yeah, I say in the chat room they're talking about the Welsh and the Cimmerians or Cymru.
Well, those Cymri that they dispersed in the Hungarian plains and went in different directions, and some of them went all the way to Spain, and others crossed into Britain, and they were the coming of the new Celts as opposed to the Phoenician proto Celts, right?
Okay, right.
But they a great number of them settled on the northern shores of Germany along the Baltic and didn't cross into Britain.
Mm-hmm.
And those people were famous for wars against the Romans several hundred years later.
Are those the Phrygians?
In the 2nd century BC.
Are those the people known as the Phrygians?
No, the Cimmerians.
Okay. I mean, the people who settled on the northern, on the coast of the Atlantic. What are those people called? Because they're not called Welsh.
No, dude. I'm talking about the Cymry or the Cimmerians.
Right. Didn't you say they crossed in Europe and settled?
Well, they destroyed Phrygia on their way into Europe.
Okay. Yeah.
They overran Phrygia.
Okay.
They dispersed in the Hungarian plains basically went in different directions, and that was by 500 BC. By 400 BC. You have one group of them crossing into Britain. You have another and becoming what we know as the Cymry. You have another group of them who actually sacked Rome and became known as Gauls.
Okay.
But they had actually they branched out into many different directions. They were a large body of people. They traveled with their wives and their children in wagons, and that they split up and headed in different directions. At some point around the 5th century B.C.
Right. Okay, well, you mentioned that the Scythians were at war with the Assyrians for this 28-year period, roughly ending around 608 B.C.?
Well, they weren't at war with the Assyrians. They had hegemony over all of Asia for 28 years, and right, during that time, the Assyrian Empire fell.
Okay, because it was the Babylonians, which at this point, under Nebuchadrezzar,
right?
Well,
the Scythians withdraw from the Scythians that helped destroy Assyria withdraw from Mesopotamia.
Mm-hmm.
That's when they crossed Anatolia,
right.
And Babylon ends up with the Medes had the hegemony for a short time, but Babylon ends up with the hegemony.
Okay, so
and now the Medes were and the Persians they were under tribute to the Babylonians from the time of the Book of Nezar. But it was the Persians who, as we know, destroyed Babylon.
Yeah. Yeah. Were there any pitched battles between the Babylonians and the Assyrians, or was it a matter of attrition that the Assyrians, due to their breakup of the empire fighting other people, that the Babylonians simply took over?
Well, it's not a part of the historic record, I don't think, but I believe it's self-evident that the Babylonians are part of the forces that destroyed the Assyrians.
Okay,
but Herodotus himself doesn't mention the Babylonians in that context.
Uh-huh.
He only mentions Scythians and Medes.
I see. Okay. All right, so there's probably then a coalition of...
Right, I believe I could find an Assyrian inscriptions, Babylonian inscriptions support for my contention that the Babylonians were part of that.
Right. Okay. All right, so we're talking about the Scythians in verse 10, the Scythians making war against the Assyrians. So verse 11, I have therefore delivered him into the hand of the mighty one of the heathen. Now, this heathen was probably mistranslated here. Heathen is probably from Goyim, right? Or the Goy nation?
Well, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I have delivered him into the mighty
Yeah, because if we're talking about Scythians, then they're not heathen. They're Israel. They're Israelites. Yeah. He shall surely deal with them. I have driven him out for his wickedness. That's the judgment of Assyria. Verse 12. And strangers, the terrible of the nations, have cut him off and have left him upon the mountains, and in all the valleys of its branches are fallen, and its boughs are broken off by all the rivers of the land, and all the people of the earth are gone down from its shadow and have left him. In other words, the empire disintegrated through this coalition of different armies that we're discussing here, Medes, Scythians, Babylonians, etc. Okay? Is that what these verses are talking about?
Well, absolutely.
Yeah, okay. Now, what about strangers? because maybe some of these, they would be foreigners in terms of the Assyrians, as far as the Assyrians are concerned, but not foreigners in terms of being Israelites. Because the Medes,
well, strangers, the terrible of the nations, Natash, to leave, permit, forsake. What if that was to say, and the estranged ones, the terrible of nations, have cut them off?
Very good. Very good.
And it could very well say that.
Yes.
And it could be a reference. Yeah, you know, when we covered Isaiah, I believe we pointed out all of the places where it says explicitly that the children of Israel would be involved in the destruction of both Assyria and Babylon.
Okay. Very good.
And why wouldn't that say that here? But how? And that's how I would read that here.
Yeah,
the estranged ones, the terrible of the nations, cut him off.
Yeah, and we found that even in the New Testament, the King James fails to understand that estranged, that the actual Greek is estranged, but they still translate it as stranger.
Well, right, but the estranged ones are the children of Israel.
That's right. That's right. Very good. Verse 13, upon its ruin shall all the fowls of heaven remain, and all the beasts of the field shall be upon its branches. Okay, so whoever remained in the land will be, I guess, the shepherds and farmers, what have you. Verse 14, to the end that none of all the trees by the waters exalt themselves for their height, neither shoot up their top among the thick boughs, neither their trees stand up in their height, all that drink water, for they are all delivered to death, to the nether parts of the earth, in the midst of the children of men, which would be Adam here, right, with them that go down to the pit. Thus says Yahweh, in the day that he went down to the grave, I caused the mourning, I covered the deep for him, and I restrained the floods thereof, and the great waters were stayed, and I caused Lebanon to mourn for him, and all the trees of the field fainted for him. Okay, so that's the destruction of the Assyrian Empire.
Right. Now let me say, because there was some confusion earlier, I'm giving more or less an off-the-cuff description of this history. Yeah, you know, in the book, the Medes had hegemony for a short time after the fall of the Assyrians, when Nebuchadnezzar took that throne in Babylon, he earned hegemony through his warfare and his conquest.
Right.
Okay? He fought for hegemony in Mesopotamia. However, Babylonian hegemony basically only lasted for his reign and the reign of a couple of his successors who were short-lived.
Right. Right.
All right? Because Cyrus, I believe, invaded and destroyed Babylon in 539 B.C.
Right.
That's, you're only talking about a period of about 65 years, and Nebuchadnezzar himself ruled for about 40 of them.
Mm-hmm.
He ruled for a long time.
Yes, yes. Yeah, so, yeah, Babylon was not that long-lived as far as his empires go.
Well, this is, the second Babylonian empire.
Right, right, yes.
It was not very long-lived.
Yes, very good. Okay, verse 16. I made the nations to shake at the sound of his fall when I cast him down to hell with them that descend into the pit, and all the trees of Eden, which I agree with you, in these verses here, it could only mean the descendants of Noah in Genesis 10.
Well, right, absolutely. We are the trees of Eden. You're descended from Noah, and your race is one of the trees of Eden.
The choice and best of Lebanon, all that drink water shall be comforted in the nether parts of the earth. And, of course, when you have this, because obviously the Assyrians were a very tyrannical kingdom, very cruel, putting people's eyes out and, making them be slaves. It was a very cruel empire.
Well, the Persians did a lot of the same things, too.
Uh-huh.
But when you disgraced yourself or your nation in Persia, that they made you walk around without ears and eyes, ears and a nose. They would cut off your ears and your nose.
Yeah.
and I believe the Assyrians practiced this, too. Well, when you made a traitorous act against the government, they would go and destroy your whole village.
Uh-huh.
All your kin would suffer for your stupidity.
Right, right, yeah. So you had to be careful, yes. Verse 17, they also went down into hell with him to them that be slain with the sword, and that they were his arm that dwelled under his shadow in the midst of the heathen. To whom are you thus like in glory and in greatness among the trees of Eden? Yet shall you be brought down with the trees of Eden to the nether parts of the earth. You shall lie in the midst of the uncircumcised with them that be slain with the sword. This is Pharaoh and all his multitude, says Yahweh Elohim. Any comment on this? and that you shall lie in the midst of the uncircumcised.
Well, you know, well, first Pharaoh and the Egyptians were circumcised.
Okay.
All right. But you know, this is all the trees of Eden have been destroyed by aliens.
Okay.
Except the children of Israel.
Uh-huh.
Well, where are the trees? Where are the Assyrians? Where are the Egyptians? Where are the Persians?
Yeah, they're gone.
And we'll see this later also. But yes, they're all gone.
Mm-hmm.
Now the Assyrians, a group of them, or I should say a rather large settlement of them, it's recorded by Diodorus Siculus, who Diodorus Siculus's Library of History, what was actually compiled from all the great ancient Greek historians who are lost to us now.
Okay.
I mean, there are many. Now Diodorus Siculus compiled all of their works into his own. He's not a writer. He's a compiler. He admits that in his work.
Okay.
Now, he recorded that the Scythians, when they retreated across the Caucasus, not the Scythians that destroyed the Nineveh, but the Scythians that later fought with the Persians.
Okay.
Okay. They, too, crossed the Caucasus and ended up migrating into Europe. The Scythians did, you know, our people migrated into Europe in several large continuous waves of migrations.
Yeah.
Now, these Scythians had dwelt along the river Araxes, which is right in the cities of the Medes, right, and of that time. Now they had a great battle with Cyrus, the king of the Persians, and they defeated him, and eventually they migrated north of the Caucasus around the Black Sea into Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And Diodorus Siculus says that when they crossed into, you know, through the Caucasus, that they had actually taken by force large settlements of both Medes and Assyrians.
Okay.
And settled them along the River Tanais north of the Black Sea. The River Tanais is the modern Don.
Okay.
It empties from southern Russia and into the Black Sea from the north.
Right, right. Yeah, and I think it goes straight north into Russia.
And that, well, that should be the Ukraine today, I think. Possibly.
Yes, right, yes. Belarus, et cetera, right. Yeah, those small nations just north of the Caucasus.
Right. So Diodorus attests that, that the Scythians took the Slavic peoples.
Uh-huh.
That, I mean, they became known as Slavic peoples, the Sarmatians.
Yeah.
And that's where Diodorus says that they came from settlements of the Assyrians and the Medes. And yet, you know, Yahweh says of the Scythians, of the Israelites, that you shall take captive those who took you captive.
Right, right. And now, just to clarify, the Assyrians were Shemites, but the Medes were Japhethites?
They were Japhethites.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, very good. All right, chapter 32, verse 1. And it came to pass in the 12th year, in the 12th month, in the first day of the month, that the word of Yahweh came to me, saying, any comment here about the chapter orders at this point? You had something that this is different in the Septuagint.
Well, yes, this is out of order too, right? Ezekiel 32:1 is written in the 12th year, in the 12th month of the captivity.
Okay.
Okay? But when we get to Ezekiel 32, verses 21, I'm sorry, Ezekiel
17?
33, verses 21 to 33, all right?
Uh-huh.
That records the fall of Jerusalem transpiring in the 10th month of the 12th year of the captivity.
Okay. Yeah.
So those verses should be before these verses.
Right. Right.
And those verses record the actual report of the fall of Jerusalem.
Okay. Okay. All right. Very good. I think we'll get to that today. All right. So chapter 32, verse 2. Son of man, take up a lamentation for Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and say to him, you are like a young lion of the nations, and you are as a whale in the seas.
Now let me say that we have already seen the in verses 29:17 through 30:19, right?
Mm-hmm.
What we've already seen, what's recorded is the final destruction of Tyre and Egypt.
Right.
Which happened in 570 and 568, respectively, B.C. Now this is... That was where it said that it was the 27th year of Ezekiel, you know, of the captivity.
Oh, okay, okay.
Okay, so this is actually, this should have been before that text.
Right.
Okay, this lamentation.
Right, right, exactly. Yeah, and that was done by the Babylonians under Nebuchadnezzar,
yes.
The son of Nebuchadrezzar. Yes,
yes.
Okay. All right, continue with verse 2. And you troubled the waters with your feet and fouled their rivers. Thus says Yahweh, I will therefore spread out my net over you with a company of many people, and they shall bring you up in my net. And, of course, this company of many people that what invaded Egypt would have been the Babylonians.
Yes.
Right? Okay.
Absolutely.
Verse 4, then will I leave you upon the land. I will cast you forth upon the open field and will cause all the fowls of the heaven to remain upon you. And that would include some Nubians, no doubt. and I will fill the beasts of the whole earth with you. More Nubians.
Yeah, you know, once one looks at the history of Egypt,
yeah,
one can only conclude that these are all euphemisms for the fate of Egypt, that it would be overrun by people of other races.
That's right. No doubt. Very good. Verse 5. And I will lay your flesh upon the mountains and fill the valleys with your height. I will also water with your blood the land wherein you swim, even to the mountains, and the rivers shall be full of you. So when the Babylonians invaded, there was great bloodshed. Verse 7, and when I shall put you out, I will cover the heaven and make the stars thereof dark. I will cover the sun with a cloud, and the moon shall not give her light. Very reminiscent of Revelation chapter 12. Of course, this is particular to the Egyptians, to the Pharaoh, that his lights are going to go out. Verse 8, all the bright lights of heaven will I make dark over you and set darkness upon your land, says Yahweh.
Now, let me say that the stars, and that they're really reminiscent of, often that's used of Israelite people, right?
Okay,
But it can also be considered to be used of Adamic people, and the sun and moon are metaphors for the government.
Yes, right, exactly. Now, what's your take on the Babylonians at this point in history? Because the days of Nimrod are long gone.
Well, they're clearly a mixed race. They're primarily Chaldean. They're Aramean in descent,
uh-huh.
The Chaldees, okay?
Yeah.
The Casti, it's Casti in Hebrew.
Right.
But they're descended from the Syrians.
Yes.
They came from Syria, and conquered Babylonia at an early time.
Uh-huh.
Now the Kenites are in Babylonia, and they always had been.
Right.
And Babylonia was a great merchant city. And it was for thousands of years.
Yes.
And I can't imagine it being unmixed like any other merchant city.
Right. And one of the major groups of the Kenites were the Sepharvaim, from whom the Sephardic Jews get their name.
Well, right. And,
yes.
And Clifton had done a lot of work on researching the religions of early Mesopotamia and demonstrating how in Babylonia there was always a struggle between those who worship the sun god Bel and those who worship the moon god Sin.
Okay.
And that seemed to represent the Kenite race and the Adamic race.
Okay. Okay.
And I sort of have to agree with that. I mean, I can't disagree with it.
And the Baal worshippers would be the Kenites.
No, the Baal worshippers would have, the worshippers of the moon god Sin, I believe.
Okay.
Originally. That's the spin I get. I might be wrong. Clearly
but either
right.
Way, they're not Yahweh.
Right. It's
lesser gods.
It's two different flavors of paganism,
right?
Right. And which one you want to adopt.
Yeah, right. Right, chocolate or vanilla, right? Verse 9, I will also vex the hearts of many people when I shall bring your destruction among the nations into the countries which you have not known. So there's going to be a lot of Egyptian captives. Verse 10, yea, I will make many people amazed at you, and their kings shall be horribly afraid for you when I shall brandish my sword before them, and they shall tremble at every moment, every man for his own life, in the day of your fall. For thus says Yahweh, the sword of the king of Babylon shall come upon you, but by the swords of the mighty will I cause your multitude to fall, the terrible nations, all of them, and they shall spoil the pomp of Egypt, and all the multitude thereof shall be destroyed. Of course, the pomp of Egypt was something to behold even today, right? People have no idea how these huge stone monuments were constructed, and very beautiful stone monuments. Verse 30,
and much more at that time.
Yeah.
Right? Much more beautiful at that time.
Exactly, right. Verse 13, I will destroy also the beasts of there from beside the great waters. Neither shall the foot of man trouble them any more, nor the hoofs of the beasts trouble them. Then will I make their waters deep and cause their rivers to run like oil. What's the symbolism here? Cause the rivers to run like oil, thick like muck.
Well, I would think that maybe oil is it seems to me that the beasts would thrive in Egypt.
It's
hard to decipher these verses. I'd probably have to read a couple other versions.
Right, it's definitely metaphoric here. Okay,
but the word beast is behemoth in both of these cases.
Okay,
which is the word that's often used as metaphorically as two-legged beasts.
Right. Yes. Very good. Verse 15. When I shall make the hand of Egypt desolate, and the country shall be destitute of what thereof it was full, when I shall smite all them that dwell therein, then shall they know that I am Yahweh.
Now not everyone in Egypt died.
Yes.
Right? But he's going to smite all of them that dwell therein.
Mm-hmm.
Now, therefore, this has to be talking about everyone of a certain variety.
Uh-huh.
The real Egyptians. That's how I read this. It's evident in history and that the ethnography of Egypt changed drastically since this very time.
Right, right.
That Egypt was filled with white Adamic men.
Yes, Hamites.
And they would be overrun with these beasts, and they became destitute, and all of those white Adamic men
mm-hmm.
were smitten.
Right, right. Was it after the Babylonians pulled out that the Nubian, that brief Nubian kingdom?
Well, no, that had already taken place.
That had already taken place.
The brief Nubian, but that didn't destroy Egypt because the Egyptians threw them off.
Okay.
However, I believe that Yahweh used that as the method that would eventually destroy Egypt.
Right.
Because that Nubian blood never left and
uh-huh.
eventually consumed the entire kingdom.
Right. That's why they're called Arabs today. Right. Verse 16. This is the lamentation wherewith they shall lament her. The daughters of the nations shall lament her. They shall lament for her, even for Egypt and for all her multitude, says Yahweh. Okay, now here we have another dating. Verse 17. It came to pass also in the 12th year, in the 15th day of the month. Okay, we're just talking a few days later now here, right? The first day, 2 weeks later. The word of Yahweh came to me, saying, Son of man, wail for the multitude of Egypt and cast them down, even her and the daughters of the famous nations, to the nether parts of the earth, with them that go down into the pit. Now, could this possibly be taken as captives taken south into Nubia? Or is it just, it's just metaphorical, down into the pit?
Well, I think it's, for the multitude of Egypt and cast them down. You might want to think that it could be taken metaphorically for captives taken south, but I think that it's only metaphorical
for defeat.
That Egypt is going.
Yes.
You know that it's going to be no more. That these people, that these white people in Egypt, are going to be destroyed and outbreeded and.
Right, and replaced, yes.
Okay. Replaced with what's there today.
Yes, very good. Okay, verse 19. Whom do you pass in beauty? Go down and be you laid with the uncircumcised.
Now, Herodotus the historian attested that the Egyptians practiced circumcision.
Okay.
But when we read forward here into the rest of this chapter, it's evident that this, I believe, has a much greater meaning here. It indicates to me that all of the nations of old were going to disappear. Yeah, this is why the promise of preservation was so important to Israel.
Uh-huh.
Because the entire old white world was wiped out.
Mm-hmm.
And people don't realize that. A lot of people identity don't realize that. All of these Mesopotamian nations were white, and northern African nations were white. And Yahweh is saying they are all going to be destroyed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and they all were.
Yeah, because they fought each other. And then, had periods of internal decline, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, so that's why they declined. And, of course, that many of the Japhethites moved north into Europe long before the Israelites. And then
right. There may be some of them among us, and there certainly are in fulfillment of Genesis. I think it's 9:28 or 29 that Japheth would dwell in the tents of Shem.
Right.
And we certainly have them among us today. And some of us, or many of us, are probably in part descended from them.
Yes, yes.
But they have no national identity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but the Israel determines their national identity. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, very good. Verse 20, they shall fall in the midst of them that are slain by the sword. She is delivered to the sword. Draw her and all her multitudes. The strong among the mighty shall speak to him out of the midst of hell with them that help him. They are gone down. They lie uncircumcised, slain by the sword. Asher, okay, is there, and all her company. His graves are about him, all of them slain, fallen by the sword. Okay, so we're talking about the, this is the correct translation for Assyria, right?
Well, right. Right. Now, Asher was the son of Shem.
Yes, very good. Verse 23, whose graves are set in the sides of the pit, and her company is round about her grave. All of them slain, fallen by the sword, which caused terror in the land of the living. So I think from verse 22 we can surmise that from the previous invasion of Egypt by the Assyrians, that there were still a lot of Assyrians there, okay, that stayed there among the Egyptians. Verse 24, there is Elam and all her multitude round about her grave. All of them slain, fallen by the sword, which are gone down uncircumcised into the nether parts of the earth, which caused their error in the land of the living, yet have they borne their shame with them that go down into the pit. Now, to what extent were the Elamites involved in all
this? Well, I think this is a long-term prophecy.
Okay.
Which is stating that all of these nations are going to be destroyed.
Okay. Okay. Verse 25, they have set her abed in the midst of the slain with all her multitude. Her graves are round about him, all of them uncircumcised, slain by the sword. Though their terror was caused in the land of the living, yet have they borne their shame with them that go down to the pit. He is put in the midst of them that be slain.
Let me say that the Elamites, that they were, that you know, the Persian Empire, what was the core of the Persian Empire was Elam.
Okay.
That the Elamites, they're the Persians, and they thrived until about the 2nd century BC when they were overtaken by the Parthians,
right,
who were a part of the dispersion of Israel,
okay,
who dwelt by the Caspian Sea and never crossed into Europe. They stayed, they tarried behind.
Mm-hmm.
And they came to rule over all Persia and all the way to the Euphrates.
Yes.
So they really came to rule over all Persia and all of what had been Babylonia and Assyria also.
Yeah. So it would be correct to describe the Persians as uncircumcised Shemites, definitely relatives of the Hebrews.
Well, yes, the Persians are, just like the Assyrians, uncircumcised Shemites.
Okay, very good.
Because Elam was also a brother of Arphaxad and a son of Shem.
Okay.
Now, the Persian people still existed at the time of the Parthian hegemony, which lasted about 400 or 500 years until the 2nd or 3rd century AD,
okay,
when Persia, for a short time, regained that hegemony.
Mm-hmm.
But they were overrun by the Arabs. They were overrun by the Khazars, the Jewish-Turkish Khazar trading,
right,
empire. They were overrun by the Turks, and they were overrun by the Mongols.
Right.
Until about the 11th century AD, there's nothing left of Elam.
Right.
I would be absolutely shocked if,
mm-hmm,
there was one Elamite left.
Right. Yes.
By the Middle Ages.
A pure-blooded Elamite, right.
Right.
Yeah.
And a lot of people point to these people today and say, oh, they look white. Well,
yeah.
Well, not. It's close.
Right.
But no cigar.
Right, right. Wouldn't that be the territory of the,
modern Iran is Elam.
Okay, yes, yeah. And the modern Iranians consider themselves to be, distinct from the Arabs.
Well, yes, they do, and they hate the Arabs, but there's a lot of that blood in them.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so they're a little bit more white than the Arabs. Okay, verse 26. Now, here's a couple interesting words. There is Meshech, Tubal, and all her multitude. Her graves are round about him, all of them uncircumcised, slain by the sword, though they caused their terror in the land of the living. Now, I think it'd be a mistake to refer to these two names here as the cities of Moscow and Tobolsk. I think
Tobolsk. I don't think it's much of a mistake. I think that those people did migrate up through the Caucasus.
Oh, no doubt. No doubt.
With the Scythians, and that they are represented by what we know today as Moscow and Tobolsk.
Right, yeah.
They did inhabit the region around the Black Sea immediately south of the Caucasus Mountains
uh-huh.
at the time of Herodotus, and he mentioned the Moschi and the Tobarni.
Uh-huh. Okay, okay. So the main points of settlement would have been Tobolsk and Moscow.
I believe so.
Yes.
I believe that that's a very fair connection.
Right. But my question was whether at this point in history they would have already settled those
points. No, they were living along the Black Sea at this point.
Okay. All right, very good. Verse 27.
And I'm sure a great number of them were destroyed as allies of the Assyrians and later of the Medes.
Uh-huh.
And a great number of them probably did come to an end.
Yes, and of course these are also descendants of Japheth, so where they were not Shemites, but Japhethites, okay? Verse 27, and they shall not lie with the mighty that are fallen of the uncircumcised, which are gone down to hell with their weapons of war, and they have laid their swords under their heads, but their iniquities shall be upon their bones, though they were the terror of the mighty in the land of the living. So at one point, these Japhethites were a terror, and you said, were they allied with the Medes, part of the Medes?
Well, they were kindred to the Medes. I believe that they were also the part of the people called Urartu in the ancient.
Okay.
And they were often at war with the Assyrians.
Right. Right. Okay. Very good. Verse 28. Yea, you shall be broken in the midst of the uncircumcised, and shall lie with them that are slain with the sword. Now Edom. Okay. There is Edom. Her kings and all her princes, which with their might are laid by them that were slain by the sword, they shall lie with the uncircumcised, well, they are uncircumcised, and with them, at this point in history, and with them that go down to the pit. Now, are we talking about the Hittites?
Well, most of these people are uncircumcised at this time.
Yes.
And they're all to lie with the uncircumcised.
Mm-hmm.
But the Edomites were subdued by the Babylonians. There's no doubt. And later, when the Babylonians leveled Jerusalem, the Edomites took part in that as a subject nation.
Uh-huh.
You know, that they as part of their tribute, they gave forces to the Babylonians to attack Jerusalem.
Yes, yes. Okay, very good. Pharaoh shall see them and shall be comforted over all his multitude, even Pharaoh and all his army slain by the sword. Now, why would he be comforted by seeing all his multitude slain by the sword? Is there something wrong here?
And shall be comforted over all his multitude, even
yes,
Pharaoh
yes.
and all his army slain by. I don't know. That's a little strange.
Do you have the Greek Septuagint there?
I have. Yes, I do.
Okay. Because that's the, every once in a while you run into these verses that don't make any sense. And this looks like it's one of them. But while you're looking for that, let me keep reading.
Well, I have it. The NAS said, these Pharaoh will see, and he will be comforted for all his multitudes. He will be comforted for all his multitudes slain by the sword.
Okay.
In other words, he will be comforted because he's mourning over his multitude.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay.
And that's not very clear
in the King James. Right.
But it's much clearer in the NAS.
All right.
King Pharaoh shall see them, and he shall be comforted over all their force. According to the Septuagint, and the Septuagint leaves out the part about, Pharaoh's own army being...
Okay, I see. All right, very good. Verse 32, for I have caused my terror in the land of the living, and he shall be laid in the midst of the uncircumcised with them that are slain with the sword. Even Pharaoh and all his multitude, says Yahweh. Okay.
Now I believe that this is a long range prophecy. This chapter 32.
Okay.
It's not a short range prophecy, and it explains the demise of the old Adamic oikoumene, and it certainly has happened, as it is fully evident now. Most of these nations are entirely gone, and most of them are gone by the time of Christ.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, I think I missed verse 30. There be the princes of the north, all of them, and all of the Zidonians, which are gone down with the slain. With their terror, they are ashamed of their might, and they lie uncircumcised with them that be slain by the sword, and bear their shame with them that go down to the pit. So all of these, and the Zidonians would be part of the Edomite nation as well. Okay.
Well, no, they would be the princes of the north. That would be the Syrians and all the petty kingdoms. Along the northern coast of the Mediterranean,
okay.
all the way probably to to Armenia or to Carchemish at least.
Okay, now, because what's her name? Jezebel was a Sidonian. Okay, was she a Canaanite or was she like a...
Well that's priest? Debatable. It's always debatable. Jezebel's father was a Baal priest.
Okay.
Okay, he was a Baal priest who usurped the throne of Hiram.
Okay.
Okay, he took...
And Hiram was an Israelite.
Hiram was definitely an Israelite.
Mm-hmm.
But Josephus records in Against Appian that Ithobal, who's the Ethbaal of Scripture and the father of Jezebel, was a Baal priest who usurped the throne of Hiram.
Okay.
Now there were a lot of Israelite Baal priests.
Right.
But there were also a lot of Canaanite Baal
right.
priests.
Right. Okay. And so it's unclear.
It's very unclear. It can't be pinned down as to whether Jezebel's a Canaanite or an Israelite.
Or just a rebellious.
It can be argued either way. There's really no way of knowing.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Very good. All right. So chapter 33. Verse 1, again the word of Yahweh came to me, saying, Son of man, speak to the children of your people, and say to them, when I bring the sword upon the land, if the people of the land take a man of their coasts and set them for their watchmen, if when he sees the sword come upon the land, he blow the trumpet and warn the people. These are the verses that I began, that I opened my book, The Great Impersonation, with, because this is what the watchman is supposed to do, folks.
Well, right, and I think Roosevelt and Pearl Harbor when this happens, right?
Right.
But let all those Adamic men die. Let all those white soldiers die. It's
right.
The nation, right?
Right, and the vast majority of the church men today are not playing the part of watchmen. They're asleep. They're asleep on the tower, and they don't see the invasion happening. Let me repeat verse 3, if when he sees the sword come upon the land, he blow the trumpet and warn the people, then whosoever hears the sound of the trumpet and takes not warning, if the sword come and take him away, his blood shall be upon his own head. Okay, you have to, the watchman has to blow the trumpet.
Well, right, if you know something's going to happen and you don't open your mouth about it, you're guilty of murder.
Right, yeah, and so the Christian Zionists today are letting the enemy swarm in, and they're celebrating.
Well, they're
it.
All guilty of murder because they have abetted the enemy.
Right.
They worship Satan. They've abetted Satan. They're all guilty of murder.
They've opened
they're
the gates.
Guilty of hundreds of millions of murders.
Yeah, they open the gates and let the enemy swarm in. Verse 4, then whosoever hears the sound of the trumpet and takes not warning, if a sword come and take him away, his blood shall be upon his own head. Verse 5, he heard the sound of the trumpet and took not warning. His blood shall be upon him, but he that takes warning shall deliver his soul. So it's important when you hear the alarm, take warning. Verse 6, but if the watchman see the sword come and blow not the trumpet, and the people be not warned, if the sword come and take any person from among them, he is taken away in his iniquity, that's the watchman, but his blood will I require at the watchman's hand. So all these priests who are failing to blow the trumpet, failing to warn the people, Yahweh will judge them. Verse 7.
Now let me say that we have to take this as an example for us.
Oh, yeah.
We must testify to Israel concerning their sin and their iniquity every chance we get.
Right.
Or we're just as responsible for it.
Yes.
Now, here in this next verse, we'll see that this is, in verse 7, we saw that this is being spoken of, that all of this burden is being put on Ezekiel directly, right?
Yes, yes. Well, every prophet, if the prophet doesn't preach the true word, then he's not a true watchman. He's playing the wrong role. Verse 7, so you, O son of man, I have set you a watchman to the house of Israel. Therefore you shall hear the word at my mouth and warn them from me. Of course, very few Christian ministers are giving any warnings. They're actually, encouraging people to take part in all of these self-destructive wars. Verse 8, when I say to the wicked, O wicked man, you shall surely die. If you do not speak to warn the wicked from his way, that wicked man shall die in his iniquity, but his blood will I require at your hand. In other words, the preachers, not just the watchmen, but the preachers, if they don't tell the people that they're doing wrong, that they're doing iniquity, these preachers will be judged accordingly.
Well, right. I think that burden falls. We're all a kingdom of priests. I think that burden falls onto everybody that's aware of this.
Right, right. So we can't keep silent about it.
And I hate the people in the chat room might curse me, but
no,
they're aware of it now.
We can't keep silent about this. You know, our race is under attack by the perfidious Jew and the swarms of aliens that he's bringing into our nations. So no doubt about this. Verse 9, nevertheless, if you warn the wicked, and we're talking wicked Israelites, if you warn the wicked of his way to turn from it, if he do not turn from his way, he shall die in his iniquity, but you have delivered your own soul. So we are, no matter what, we are to give the warning. If they do not heed the warning, then it's not our fault. Okay? But if they do heed the warning, then both our souls are saved. Very nice. Okay? And that's a win-win situation if they heed the warning, right? Verse 10. Therefore, O you son of man, speak to the house of Israel. Thus you speak, saying, if our transgressions and our sins be upon us, and we pine away in them, how should we then live? Now, of course, pine in modern parlance means you're feeling sorry for yourself.
Well, it means that you're wasting away.
Wasting away. Okay.
I'm going to go check that.
Okay, that's a little more descriptive. Wasting away in your sins, how should we then live? Verse 11. Say to them, as I live, says Yahweh, I have no pleasure in the death of the wicked, but that the wicked turn from his way and live. Turn you from your evil ways, for why will you die, O house of Israel?
To pine away, and it is number 47, 43, macaque. It means to decay.
Decay.
Or to rot.
Waste away.
Victims decaying in their sins.
Right. Exactly. Because they're either not heeding the warning or they haven't been given the warning. Yes. So let me repeat verse 11. Say to them, as I live, says Yahweh, I have no pleasure in the death of the wicked. And of course, we're still talking about Israelites here. But that the wicked turn from his way and live. Turn you from your evil ways. For why will you die, O house of Israel? Of course, we die because of our sins. Verse 12. Therefore, you son of man, say to the children of your people, the righteousness of the righteous shall not deliver him in the day of his transgression, or other people's righteousness. As for the wickedness of the wicked, he shall not fall thereby in the day that he turns from his wickedness. Neither shall the righteous be able to live for his righteousness in the day that he sins. A kind of obscure language here. What do you have in the Septuagint there?
Well, the righteousness of the righteous shouldn't deliver a sinner in a day of wickedness. There's no doubt that this is verse 12, right?
Okay.
But I have to be right on it to get to it in the Septuagint. Say to the children of thy people, the righteousness of the righteousness of the righteous shall not deliver him. In other words, you can't count on the righteous man, that you have to cease from your own sin, right?
Right. Okay.
In the day wherein he errs.
Okay, so the cavalry won't necessarily save you.
Okay. Well, if you're a sinner, Yahweh's not going to save you because there's good men in your
in your company,
in your environment.
Right.
If we go back to the days of Lot, the city was if there was one good man found in Sodom, Yahweh said he wouldn't destroy it, right?
Yes. Yes.
Well, there wasn't, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, this definitely does not teach that we're all saved for believing, right? Verse 13, when I shall say to the righteous that he shall surely live, if he trusts to his own righteousness and commit iniquity, all his righteousness shall not be remembered, but for his iniquity that he has committed, he shall die for. So in other words, if you turn away from Yahweh's law and live according to your own rules, that's no good, folks.
Well, right. And we saw the same thing earlier in Ezekiel in chapter 3 and elsewhere. And note 3:20 says that, again, when a righteous man turns from his righteousness and commits iniquity, and I lay a stumbling block before him, he shall die.
Mm-hmm.
And Paul says that once you've tasted of the beneficence of Yahweh and have accepted your redemption,
yeah,
and resort to sin, that there's no more sacrifice for you.
Yes, yes. Okay, verse 14, again, when I say to the wicked, you shall surely die, if he turn from his sin and do that which is lawful and right, if the wicked restore the pledge, give again that he had robbed, walked in the statutes of life without committing iniquity, he shall surely live, he shall not die. Okay, so your life and the law are intimately connected. Righteousness gives life, unrighteousness causes death. Verse 16, none of his sins that he has committed shall be mentioned to him. He has done that which is lawful and right, he shall surely live. Now, of course, Yahweh is very forgiving. But this also would be a prophecy of the sacrifice at the cross, wouldn't it? Here in verse 16.
The well, I guess it could be read that way, yes.
Yes, okay.
Now, none of his sins he has committed. Well, Christ had no sins.
Right.
And he did that which is lawful and right.
Right.
And I think it could be accepted as a prophecy,
as well.
The redemption. But remember also that these words, because the scrolls are out of order,
yeah,
that these words should all be uttered right after the fall of Jerusalem.
Uh-huh. Oh, okay.
And they're talking about the Israelites, the last of them here, because Jerusalem is the last part of Israel destroyed.
Right.
And they're talking about the Israelites. They are instructions for the Israelites going off into captivity.
Ah, okay. Okay. Very good. Verse 17, yet the children of your people say, the way of Yahweh is not equal, but as for them, their way is not equal. What do you mean, right? Equal? Are they saying?
Well, fair.
Fair.
Equitable.
Ah, okay, fair. Yet the children refuse, yeah, the way of the Lord is not fair. Of course, that's what the people say, you know, his law is not fair. We want to do our way, you know, but their way is not fair. When the righteous turns from his righteousness and commits iniquity, he shall even die thereby.
So you could be the greatest guy in the world for 60 years and molest one kid.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you know, that's we can't fall into sin. We can't allow ourselves to fall into sin.
Right.
But be the nicest guy in the world for 100 years and go kill one of your brethren.
Right.
And you're nothing.
Yes, exactly, yeah. But verse 19, but if the wicked turn from his wickedness and do that which is lawful and right, he shall live thereby.
That's the prodigal son.
Right, right. Verse 20, yet you say the way of Yahweh is not equal, O you house of Israel, or fair. I will judge you, everyone, after his ways, okay? Those of us who think that Yahweh is not fair or just or kind or merciful, he most definitely is. Verse 21, and it came to pass in the 12th year of our captivity, in the 10th month and the 5th day of the month, that one that had escaped out of Jerusalem came to me saying, the city is smitten. Okay, so is this a report that the final wave of captives is getting ready to take place?
Well, yes. This is a report of the final destruction of Jerusalem.
Okay.
And the final captivity of the children of Israel.
Right. Yeah, and
they were children of Israel,
right,
for the most part.
Exactly. Yeah, right. Well, Judahites are Israelites. You know, even after the return, the Judahites of the house of Judah referred to themselves as Israel. Okay? So they didn't make the whole, but they understood they were the tribe of Judah, and of course there were Benjamites and Levites among them as well. Those were the three main categories among them. And so what we, just to refresh people's memories here, that this book of Ezekiel, that Ezekiel was one of the earlier captives. He was taken in the first wave, and that was around what year? Was that 590 B.C.?
Well, Ezekiel, all right.
Or
Daniel was taken as a hostage in 605 B.C.
605, okay.
In the third year of Jehoiakim, and Ezekiel was taken with Jehoiachin, with the 10,000 of the principal men and craftsmen of Judah, circa 597 B.C.
597.
This
okay.
is the 12th year of that captivity.
Uh-huh.
So it is 585 B.C. roughly
that
Jerusalem falls.
The
now
final
remember
fall.
That these verses should be sooner in Ezekiel than they are.
Right.
That
okay.
Actually, the text of Ezekiel 33, verses 21 through 33, should be placed before chapter 32.
Okay.
Since it records the fall of Jerusalem as transpiring.
Right. Don't confuse me.
But all of these instructions that we read on sin in chapter 32.
Right.
And all of these prophecies concerning the other Adamic nations should have followed this report that Jerusalem is destroyed.
Right.
And then the book of Ezekiel would probably make more sense.
Right.
It does.
If it was
chronological.
Exactly.
And the final destruction of Tyre and of Egypt, that should be, that we saw in Ezekiel 29, that should be the last chapter of Ezekiel.
That should be dead last. Right. Okay, very good. Verse 22. Now the hand of Yahweh was upon me in the evening before he that was escaped came and had opened my mouth until he came to me in the morning, and my mouth was open and I was no more dumb. When the word of Yahweh came to me saying, so upon recognizing this, hostage from Jerusalem, he says, verse 24, son of man, they that inhabit those wastes of the land of Israel speak, saying, Abraham was one, and he inherited the land, but we are many. The land is given us for an inheritance. Well, it is given to Israel as an inheritance, but through constant sinfulness, they were taken captive. So the land was taken away from them. Verse 20.
Now this man Ezekiel's talking to, he's not a hostage. I don't think he may have just fled.
Okay.
Because
an
escapee. Ezekiel is in, Ezekiel's actually in near Susa in Assyria.
Okay.
That's where Ezekiel is, at least by the river Kibar.
Right.
And that's at least where he starts off anyway.
Okay.
I don't think Ezekiel's in Babylonia.
Okay. So then, in other words, this person fled north and he actually escaped.
He evaded capture. First of Israel, yes.
And
seems to have evaded captivity.
Okay. Very good. Verse 25. Wherefore say to them, thus says Yahweh, you eat with the blood and lift up your eyes toward your idols and shed blood. And shall you possess the land? Of course, he's talking about the sins of the Judahites in Jerusalem. You stand upon your sword, you work abomination, and you defile everyone his neighbor's wife. And shall you possess the land? It sounds like
they're not worthy of it, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, it sounds like ancient Rome, the decline of Rome, and the current decline of America. Verse 27. Say you thus to them, thus says Yahweh Elohim, as I live, surely they that are in the waste shall fall by the sword, and him that is in the open field will I give to the beasts to be devoured, and they that be in the forts and in the caves shall die of the pestilence. For I will lay the land most desolate, and the pomp of her strength shall cease, and the mountains of Israel shall be desolate, that none shall pass through. Now we have to remember that once upon a time, especially in the days as David built up the kingdom and Solomon inherited it, the kingdom of Israel is one of the most powerful and the most famous of the ancient world. Okay? So there was definitely a great period of decline, lawlessness in Jerusalem. Of course, the 10 northern tribes were already taken captive for their lawlessness, and now the house of Judah. Verse 29.
Well, let's look real quick. You know, the Assyrians started collecting tribute from the Syrians down as far as Damascus, and actually, I believe Sidon too.
Okay, and that's just north and just west of Israelite territory.
About 100 years before the actual invasions of Israel.
Okay.
So Assyria had dominated the north country, you know, the country north of Israel,
right,
for up to 100 years before they finally got into Israel.
Yes.
And when they came into Israel, that they had 180,000 troops.
Right.
At one point, and you know, when Alexander went on his conquests 300 years later and conquered all the way to the Indus River, he embarked on his invasion of Persia with 40,000 troops. Comparatively.
Yeah.
40,000 troops.
Right.
The Assyrians going to Israel with 180,000.
Right.
That shows you what they thought of the former nation of Israel.
Right, yeah, well, that was a huge army, no doubt about it. Right, and I meant to say just north and just east of Israel. Damascus is just east.
Yes.
Yes, right, okay. shall they know that I am Yahweh when I have laid the land most desolate because of all their abominations which they have committed. Folks, he's doing this again to the house of Israel again today because we are committing abominations. And until our abominations cease, this judgment will be upon us. Verse 30. Also, you son of man, the children of your people still are talking against you by the walls and the doors of the houses and speak one to another, every one to his own brother, saying, come, I pray you, and hear what is the word that comes forth from Yahweh. And they come to you as the people come, and they sit before you as my people, and they hear your words, but they will not do them, for with their mouth they show much love, but their heart goes after covetousness. It sounds like the We Love Everybody churches today.
Well, exactly. And that's the difference between loving Yahweh in practice and loving Yahweh with your mouth.
With your mouth.
Oh, I believe in Jesus. I love Jesus.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and we want to kill all those Palestinians who did nothing to those Jews, right? The Palestinian people never did anything to the Jews. The Jews just went in and invaded. And the Jews aren't even Israelites. They have no right to that territory. And it really, in the long run, it's going to revert back to us anyway. Verse 32. And lo, you are to them as a very lovely song of one, singing songs of one that has a pleasant voice and can play well on an instrument. For they hear your words, but they do them not. Okay? Verse 33.
It's already come out many times in the program I do with Brian on Sunday nights.
Uh-huh.
The programs on Hitler, and it's going to come out on 1010 many times again when we cover the early founding fathers and their Christianity.
Right.
Real Christians don't go around saying no Yahweh.
Uh-huh.
And you have to convert Real, in fact, Jeremiah 31:31 says that, and Jeremiah chapter 31 says that the day will come when they will no longer teach know Yahweh, for they all will know me.
Right.
Now those days have long been here.
Uh-huh.
Okay? Real Christians don't go around saying, love Jesus, love Jesus, love Jesus. We all know that.
Right.
But we all have that opportunity to know that.
Right.
Real Christians build Christian principles into the philosophy of their life.
Right. Right,
and that's the difference between the lip service that all of these modern day evangelicals and these modern day Baptists
mm-hmm.
and all these other mainstream Christian sects, they only give Christianity lip service.
That's right.
And the outward appearance and exposition of being Christians.
Right.
When inside and in their life's philosophy, they have no idea what Christianity is about.
Yeah. Well, they're imitating the Pharisees who Yahshua said were whited sepulchres. On the outside, they have a form of faith. How did Paul put it? They have an outward form of faith, but inwardly there is none. There is no faith.
And that's churchianity today.
That's right. Yeah, it's really a sick modern Christianity is a sick religion.
It's empty and vain. It's a vacuum.
Yes, it's vacuous. Absolutely.
It's like a light bulb.
Yeah.
It's hard on the outside, and when you get inside, there's nothing.
Yeah, the light only shines.
A little piece of wire.
The light only shines when they turn on the switch for the services. and then everybody leaves and the light goes out, right? All right. So one more verse, and we only have about 5 minutes left, so let's just conclude with verse 33 here. And when this comes to pass, all this lip service, lo, it will come, then shall they know that a prophet has been among them. Okay. Well, you know, there's so much lip service, and obviously this was going on in the days of Old Jerusalem, okay, before the Babylonian captivity. And now Mystery Babylon has come upon us. We have a new Babylonian kingdom. It's New Babylon. That's what this really is. And there's just more lip service.
Well, absolutely.
Yeah.
Now this is, if these scrolls were in the correct order,
mm-hmm.
this would have been before the foretold destruction of all those other nations.
Okay.
And then it would have been before the portion of 33 that we just covered,
right,
should have been the last portion of 33.
Uh-huh.
And that's all the warnings about Israel and sin, because they are instructions for Israel who's being taken off into captivity.
Right.
As it
right.
says, Son of Man, speak to the children of thy people and say to them, when I bring the sword upon a land.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a warning of how they should behave in their captivity. The righteous should not turn to wickedness, and the wicked should repent, right?
Yes.
It's basic. And now we're going
right.
to go right into Ezekiel 34, and that's the story of the lost sheep and why they're lost.
Mm-hmm.
They're lost because of the wicked shepherds.
Right.
Who didn't watch the flock, right?
Yes.
And Ezekiel 34 is an excellent chapter, which shows that that Yahweh sheep are still Yahweh sheep, right?
Yes. Yes,
that there's
right.
not, that these people weren't driven off to be forgotten.
Right, right. Yeah, and there's always a remnant of law keepers, you know, even though we don't keep it perfectly, at least we're not conscious rebellious lawbreakers. You know, we all make mistakes, and Yahweh forgives us for that. But when we consciously turn to a life of sin, then he cuts us off, as he has cut so many Israelites off in the past. You know, we don't get a blank check for sin. We just don't. There's no carte blanche for sin. We always get judged for our sin. Okay? All right. Well, very good. We've covered chapter 33, and so next Friday we will start on chapter 34, and tomorrow on Yahweh's Covenant People, we will do...
2 Peter, because we only got into verse 1.
Right, and then we have some extra discussion about the historicity of 2 Peter.
Well, right. I have information from the early Christian writers on 2 Peter.
Yeah.
I think that the source that you use that held Dean 2 Peter to be spurious,
yes.
I think that he either misunderstood some of the early Christian writers or misrepresented them, one or the other.
Right, right. So,
now, the
okay.
Just as an aside, I've been trying to get back into this talk show chat. Every minute, and it's been a distraction through the whole program.
Right.
Every minute, I've been trying to get back into the chat and haven't been able to do it. I've restarted my browser.
Uh-huh.
I've restarted Firefox several times. I can't get back into the chat. It just hangs. It
right.
The window loads, and it won't let me back in.
Now that's strange, because I haven't had any problems today. And
Well, this is more of a distraction than if I'd have read the chat.
Right. Yeah, with all of the superfluous comments therein, right?
Well, right. I missed the entire chat.
Right. No. They're actually very good comments. And from what I see, no lurkers at all today. So it's been a good day for the chat room. Yeah. So, people were able to stay on point. And the last couple of comments are about Edgar Steele, and the fact that he was set up. I guess he had a new book coming out about the Jewish sex slave trade. That's not a that's a verboten topic, right? So I never believed for one second that Edgar Steele tried to kill his wife with a pipe bomb, right?
Well, the story is just absurd.
It is. But that is one subject that the Jews do not want discussed: Jewish sex trade. They don't want that discussed, so that makes a lot of sense. All right. Okay, so that'll wrap up tonight's show. We're moving along in the book of Ezekiel, and next week, chapters 34 and then 35 and 36, I think we should cover, we probably won't get through all of 36 because the heavy-duty...
Right, yeah. But next week we'll start with the lost sheep and we'll end with the imposters. There's no doubt
right,
about
right,
that.
Edomites, exactly. And there's a lot to talk about, because these prophecies about the Edomites are so accurate that, we just really have to go over those in great detail because of their, superb accuracy. They're just unbelievably, and it just proves that this is the word of Yahweh himself given through his prophets, because it is so accurate, okay? And so thank you all for listening. Thank you, Bill, for joining me again. Praise Yahweh, and Yahweh bless everybody.
Praise Yahweh.